Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a very important show on. I think that the whole COVID crisis has been, I don't know how to even put it, life-changing would be one way to put it, and also eye-opening, because now I think a lot of us are in a position of, where do we go from here? What's our economy going to be as we move past the coronavirus situation? What can we look forward to? And I have a guest on who I'm very excited to speak with, because I want to know, we hear things about an open free market economy, about having a government give us a monthly stipend, essentially. Which way should we go? So in order to answer this question, I wanted to speak today with Ms. Ellen Brown. She's an attorney, and she's the founder of Public Banking Institute. She's an author of hundreds of articles and 12 books, including her bestseller, Web of Debt. She turned those skills to an analysis of the Federal Reserve and the money trust, showing how the private cartel has usurped the power to create money from the people themselves and how we the people can get it back. Her latest book is called The Public Bank Solution and explores the successful public banking models historically and globally. She has a podcast called It's Our Money with Ellen Brown and a blog called Web of Debt at ellenbrown.com, where you can find over 300 of her blog articles. So, Ms. Brown, I want to thank you so much for coming on today. I feel like we keep getting messages, you know, from the media, but it's not really explained. And I think we are in a position now, we need to have some knowledge so that we can all make conscious choices about where we want to go financially, what's going on around us. So I want to thank you for coming on, because it's going to be an education for me as well as my listeners.
My pleasure. Thanks.
So let's start out. How did you get into economics, into becoming literally a maven for thinking deeply about our economic system?
My first career was as a lawyer, so research is sort of my, actually before that I was an English major. I really wanted to be a writer, but I couldn't support myself as a writer, so I went to law school. But research is sort of my forte. You know, I enjoy trying to figure things out and then writing it up. And in fact, I find that writing clarifies my own thinking. You know, you've got it solidified there on the screen, and you see then what's missing, and then it kind of grows. So Web of Debt, I actually wrote 10 books on health and the politics of health and the cancer business and the pharmaceutical industry, and just got deeper and deeper into the corruption of the whole thing. And then I could see that if you wanted to fix the system, you really had to fix the money system, because that's where they got their power, that banks actually create our money supply. They create it when they make loans. And I knew all the, you know, I knew about the Federal Reserve and how all that worked, but I didn't know what I could say that was different and eye-opening until I discovered that the Wizard of Oz was actually written as a monetary allegory in the 1890s, when we were going through a depression that was almost as bad as the Great Depression, and I imagine this one is coming up is liable to rival it, if not be worse. So the Wizard of Oz was actually based on a march on Washington in 1894, the first ever march on Washington by some out-of-work factory workers and farmers. So these were the Tin Man and the Scarecrow, marching all the way from Ohio to Washington, D.C., seeking a return to the greenback system of Abraham Lincoln, where the government, rather than banks, actually issued our money. The way banks issued money is complicated, and I could get into that, but I'm not sure that's what you want to focus on. But anyway, that's what they were seeking, and it was a whole populist movement. It was the closest we ever got to having a third party actually win a presidential election. The candidate was William Jennings Bryan. So Bryan was supposedly the cowardly lion, because he didn't want to go to war in the Philippines. anyway, that's a whole long story, but that was my hook for writing Web of Debt. And then after the 2008 banking crisis, I knew that we had one state that had its own bank. I had already started writing articles, so I was writing a lot of articles already about the collapse and such. And so I was watching the North Dakota, and it turned out to be the only state that escaped the credit crisis, the only state that never went into the red. It had the lowest unemployment rate in the country, the lowest default rate, the lowest foreclosure rate, and the most local banks per capita. So it was doing very well compared to the other states, and I suspect that it had something to do with its state-owned banks. So I researched that and started writing about it and generated quite a bit of interest. And so we formed a Google group, and we went round and round on the issues for a couple of years. And then we decided we were the experts, and so we needed to get out and do something, enough talking. And so we formed the Public Banking Institute in 2011. And immediately we had like 20 bills for state-owned banks. One was in California, which passed both houses of the legislature, but Jerry Brown, then the governor, didn't sign it. So, and we had that sort of problem with all these bills. You know, they made it pretty far and then they died. So now we're on our second wave of bills. We now, I think, have 25 active bills across the country and a lot, or over 50 groups that are pushing for public banks. But the idea is getting more and more popular, more and more known, mm-hmm. that we, the people, should own the banks. I mean, once you figure out that the banks are creating our money supply and that the basis of our whole, you know, what the founding fathers fought for was to have the power to issue their own money. King George had told the colonists that they could not issue paper scrip like they had been doing, and that collapsed their economy. It had collapsed their money supply because that's where their money came from. They didn't have gold, and they didn't have banks, you know, except the Bank of England. They didn't have, like, banks on every corner like we do. Mm-hmm. So they fought about it, but it's a long story. I mean, that's the whole, what I go into in Web of Debt is the whole evolution of our current system and mm-hmm. how we lost the power to issue money, even though we won the Revolutionary War. So it's about time we got that power back. That's what the populace were fighting for, and now 100 years later, it's about time we did it. And North Dakota was the one state that did come out of the populist movement where they actually successfully did get the power, at least to own their own bank, which issued money, as all banks do, as credit, you know, issued it as deposits in bank accounts for loans. And it's worked out very well. So that model has been our beacon through this whole public banking movement.
So since your book, you mentioned that North Dakota was the standard bearer. What other, are there any other states that have created their own state-run bank at this point?
No, there's American Samoa, which just got a license, a charter a year ago. And of course, they had no banks, and that's it. All their banks had collapsed. And so the Federal Reserve actually resisted for 2 years giving them a master account with the Fed, which you need in order to deal with other banks. But finally, they did it. And apparently, we heard the reason they had resisted was they didn't want to establish a precedent for mm-hmm. public banks, but they've done it now. So we've got the precedent, and we've got the Bank of North Dakota. And right now, we have a definite, stringent need.
I would agree with that. Let's revisit this and take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. We're speaking with Ms. Ellen Brown. And, you know, I personally have never heard of a state-run bank. And it sounds like it is a way to take, as you said, our power back. Can you tell us, it's a weird question, but I'm curious to know, what makes a state-run bank different than a commercial bank? Are they, they have board of directors and that sort of thing. I guess they have investors and, you know, they're always doing things to please that group within a corporate system. What's the difference, though? Am I right about that? Or is there a significant difference in how the money is doled out, the interest? The state, I assume, doesn't make money on, they're just helping their citizens. What's the difference? I'm just curious to know. I'm still a little confused.
Yeah, well, the difference is that they've cut out the middlemen. Mm-hmm. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal in 2014 that said the Bank of North Dakota was actually more profitable than Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase. That article said it was because of oil, but it definitely wasn't, because in 2014, right after that, oil collapsed, and now we have a serious collapse. But every year, the Bank of North Dakota has reported record profits. Last year, it was like 18% return on equity, which is extremely good. So what it is their business model. They've cut out all the middlemen, and their mandate is not to make money. It's actually to serve the local economy. But they don't have private shareholders. They don't have $20 million a year CEOs. They don't pay bonuses, fees, or commissions. And they're actually more like a banker's bank. So they partner with the local banks. In fact, it says in their charter that they can't compete with the local banks. So what they do is just provide liquidity and capitalization for the local banks, say on a, maybe loans that are too big for the local bank to manage on its own, and they help with regulatory requirements, that kind of thing. The way banking works and the way banks create money is that they're allowed to create 10 times as many loans or as they have capital. So if you have a pot of money, let's say you have $100 million, and if you lend that out at 3%, you're going to get 3% of that a year. If you call it capital, you're allowed to lend out 10 times as much, and then so you'll get 30% a year. I mean, you'll have costs both ways, mm-hmm. but after you'll have 30% less cost. And right now, the Federal Reserve has dropped the borrowing costs for banks to 0.25%, like it's virtually nothing. So their costs are very low right now. So this is the time to get in there and have a public bank. But anyway, that's the way it works. And if you need deposits, you would need the deposits to back the loan, supposedly, although they're really double counting the money. I could go into how that works. But by law, the Bank of North Dakota, all of North Dakota, the state's deposits all go into the bank by law. Mm-hmm. So that's their deposit base. And every state has lots of deposits. Now, it used to be that the deposits were earned, like in California, they put their excess deposits into the treasurer's investment pool, which did have the money invested in things that were very liquid, you know, so they could get their money out as needed. Mm-hmm. So they were earning 2% or so. So we would have had to pay 2% to get that money. But now those, you know, everything is making almost nothing these days. But that also means that you can get it for almost nothing. Or right now you can go right, a bank can go right to the Fed's discount window and borrow at 0.25%. And they don't even have to say that they couldn't find money anywhere else. Or, you know, it used to be sort of a, where you went when there was no other alternative. But now, just recently, as of March 15th, the Fed has said, they've just thrown the window open and said, come use our discount window, come one, come all, 0.25%. You can renew your loans daily, you know, no limits on what you use the money for. So it's really a great deal for banks, which is what they did in 2008. And, you know, you got the banks then would make very bargain basement loans to their cronies, which could then buy up everything. And that's exactly what's going to happen. It's already started to happen now. You've got all these little businesses that are going out of business, and mm-hmm. the big monopolies are going to come up and scoop them up. And what are they going to use? It's called a leverage buyout. You borrow the money, buy the thing, and then pay off the loan with the thing you just bought.
This sounds really sad, honestly, because when you look at it from the front end as the customer who puts money in the bank for money market or better yet savings, and you're getting like 0.00% interest in your savings. I mean, I know the answer to this question, but I'm just going to ask it anyway. Why doesn't it ever trickle down to us, the people who they're supposed to be working for?
Who is they? See, that's one problem, is the banks are not supposed to be working for us. I mean, they have no mandate, and that's why we want banks that are supposed to be working for us.
Mm-hmm.
And the Federal Reserve itself calls itself independent. Like, they don't have to serve the government. In fact, it's considered bad policy to serve the government, because originally the concern was that the government would use it as a money pot and just be spending on all kinds of lavish things. But the opposite has happened. The banks are using it for a money pot, and the big private corporations. They've got control of our money system. So we need to change that whole system. We need to make the central bank actually be a public utility, something that's there to serve the public and mm-hmm. that's required to serve the public.
Do you need the Federal Reserve? I mean, from what I remember from civics, Congress is supposed to mint or control the purse. How did the Federal Reserve even shoehorn their way in here, that we're borrowing money that we by right should be able to print ourselves, and we're paying interest on something? How did that even happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Constitution says Congress shall have the power to coin money mm-hmm. and regulate the value thereof, which is highly controversial what exactly that meant. But after the Revolution, the Continental Congress or the Continental Army paid for the Revolution with Continentals, which were paper receipts. And by the end of the Revolutionary War, they were worth nothing. They were totally devalued. So you got the phrase, not worth a Continental. And this was blamed on the Continental Congress printing too much money. But in fact, they didn't. It was the British who counterfeited huge amounts of this paper money, which is easy to do then. You didn't have all the safeguards, you know, where you, where you hold a thing up to the light and you see a little strip in it and stuff. And so they were just handing that paper money out to everybody in sight. They came in with shiploads of it and were handing it out. And that devalued the currency. Plus, there was the fact that this was a currency issued by an army that might lose. And so everybody would prefer to take gold or silver, you know, a metal, over this paper money of an army that might not win. Just like during the Civil War, you know, they didn't want to take the paper money of the South when it was obvious that they were going to lose or mm-hmm. apparent or seemed like it. So that devalued the currency. And then the Founding Fathers were just afraid to put it in the Constitution. And gold was considered the ideal money. So the idea was that you would stamp the coins as U.S. currency, and the coins were good money because they were obviously backed by the metal that was in them. But we now, you know, they really don't have relation to the value of the metal that's in them. We don't have gold coins anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so the after the Revolution, Congress was in financial trouble because, like, they owed gold to France and they didn't have the money, et cetera. I mean, not everybody took this paper money that they paid for things. And so to pay off those debts, Alexander Hamilton, who was the first Treasury Secretary, started the first U.S. bank based on the Bank of England, which was this model where you had 10% gold and then you could lend out these paper receipts that mm-hmm. were supposedly redeemable in gold. But you could lend out 10 times as many paper receipts as you had gold. They figured that out because people didn't really want to carry the gold around. It was safer to leave it in the bank. They liked the paper receipts, and the banks figured out that the people only came 10% of the time. So that's where they get 10-1, the 10-1 figure came in. And we still have that 10-1 figure. So we had the first U.S. bank creating money the way the Bank of England did, but that bank got into trouble and it wound up being privately owned largely by British investors. And so the first bank was shut down, and then the second bank was shut down, and then we had no national currency until the Civil War, when Lincoln issued the greenbacks, returning to the system of the American colonists. But then he was shot, and the greenbacks were that program was discontinued, and then silver was demonetized, which it used to be you could use silver or gold to back the currency. Mm-hmm. Silver was a lot easier to come by for the colonists. And so that radically shrunk the money supply. So then you had all these periodic bank runs on the bank when people would figure out that they didn't really have the gold. So I read somewhere that once every 6 years on average, we had a blank bank run and bank crisis. So we had a particularly bad one in 1907, and it was J.P. Morgan's bank that had to or did rescue the banks by being the reserves, you know, basically providing the gold for the other banks. So to avoid that, having to have one bank do it, they came up with the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. But of course, it was the Morgans and the Rothschilds, mm-hmm. or the Morgans and the Rockefellers that put the thing together. And it was obscurely worded. So William Jennings Bryan, who represented the populace of the people and was then a senator, or a congressman. Anyway, he was in Congress. And he actually thought that the populace had won. He celebrated and said, at last, we'll be issuing our own money. But that's not the way it was. It turned out the banks were issuing the money on the same Bank of England model. And that's the system we're stuck with today. And all of it is very obscurely worded so that people, A, they figure that it's too complicated for them, so they'll leave it to the experts. And B, they don't really think they need to look. Well, it's boring, for one thing. And they don't really think they need to look because when everything's running along smoothly. But in the last 10 years, it's become obvious that everything isn't running along smoothly and that we've got to throw back the curtain and look, see what's going on with the wizard in that machine.
I absolutely agree with that. And so if right now you're saying, or there's no backing to this, to our dollar, right? There's no gold or silver as a backdrop.
Oh, definitely no gold or silver.
Would that make a
Theoretically,
difference?
It didn't work for 200 years that they had periodic bank runs because there just isn't enough gold. So you're going to have paper money and nobody wants it. I mean, now it's credit cards. It's not even gold mm-hmm. or it's not even paper. So what does back our currency and should back our currency is the full faith and credit of the United States, which is the credit of the American people. So it's really like a big community currency. That's it. My latest book is actually called Banking on the People, and that was what I wrote about I set up how we could fix the system, and we could model it on the community currency system. You could have like a national community currency system, basically, where let's just acknowledge that all money is credit and debits. That's what our money is. The bank, you go to the bank and the bank partners with you. So the bank is really underwriting your own credit or giving you these dollars, which are an advance against the bank's own credit or the bank's own resources, and monetizing or turning into money your own future promise to repay. So if you're a business, let's say
let me stop you there and that thought and pick it up when we come back. We have a hard break. You're listening to Living the Solution. Welcome back to Living Solution with Dr. Elena George. Before the break, Ms. Brown, you were explaining, you know, what we need to do to, I guess, create a better system. And I cut you off, unfortunately. So if you can pick up where you left off, because you were making a really important point.
Okay, so what banks really do and where our money really comes from is they're really just monetizing our own promise to repay, which means turning our own future ability to earn money and repay into something we can spend in the marketplace. So if you went to the grocery store, if I went to my grocery store here in the big city and tried to pay with an IOU and say, you know, I'll pay you next week when I get my paycheck, the bank, the grocery store won't take it, but the bank would take it because they know where to find you, and you're maybe going to put up some collateral, and they can garnish your wages or whatever. I mean, they have ways, and you're going to pay them some interest. So they're willing to advance money. But what they do really is just write that money into your account without pulling it from anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have this whole liquidity problem of borrowing short to lend long, like they do 30-year mortgages, and they're getting their liquidity or the money to back that loan, supposedly from the deposits, which they're actually borrowing from. So it's not their own money anyway. It's the depositor's money, and they're using the depositor's money while the depositors aren't using it. But if the depositors come from the money and the borrower does it at the same time, then they've got a problem, and they've got to borrow somewhere else, and
mm-hmm.
they've got to balance their books at the end of the day. So if they don't have the money, then they borrow overnight and they give it back in the morning, which is, you know, it's clearly fraudulent. Like one party has it during the day and the other party has it at night just to make it look like the books balance. So let's just acknowledge all we're talking about here is turning your credit into money or backing it with the full faith and credit of the United States. So let's say you had a public banking system where it was just run by civil servants. They don't make anything extra. They're just doing their job, trying to decide what a good loan is. And you show them that you've got a business plan or whatever, and this is how you're going to pay it back. And they advance you the funds just by writing it into your account, just the way they do now. You don't need to draw that money from anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the function of the central bank, as we're seeing right now with all this $4 trillion, $6 trillion bailout, that they are the source of liquidity or the source of credit for the whole country. And it's backed by the full faith and credit of the whole country. So it's sort of like we're all in this community currency system and we all agree to accept each other's credits because
mm-hmm.
we know each other and trust each other. Well, in a big country, you can't know everybody in your country, but you could have a banking system that, in effect, you know, your local banker could figure out, your local public banker could figure out whether you're honest and reliable and actually will pay it back. And you will have defaults. But I've written about this, too, about a universal basic income. You actually need the defaults. Just means some extra money will be out there. You'll create some money on the books and it won't get paid back. Well, that doesn't matter. That's actually a good thing. Because if you're going to charge interest, as a public bank, of course, you'll charge less interest than the private banks are. You don't need to charge 21% on a credit card. But there would be some interest, and the interest is not created in the original loan. So that is a flaw in the whole interest-based, usury-based credit, you know, mm-hmm. debt-based system, that you're creating money as a debt, and then the money is extinguished when the debt is paid off, but you don't create the interest. So you're always drawing more money back than you put out. And you were saying, why is it that money doesn't trickle down? Why does it trickle up? That's why, because there's always more profits bleeding out of the system than going back into it, or the money going back into it. I mean, even if the bankers pay back that interest, where does the interest come from? It has to come from somewhere. So mm-hmm. it comes from another debt somewhere. That's the only place money can come from in our current system, except for that 5% or so that's actual physical coins created by, or no, it's not, well, coins and dollar bills. So very little of it is coins created by the Treasury. It's actually, even the dollar bills, you know, aren't just handed out. They're either lent or, the banks themselves have to buy them or borrow them from the Fed. So, anyway.
Well, that's quite all right. I wanted to explore universal basic income because that's something that's being talked about, but I'm not sure. There's I think, two ways that people are looking at it. Either it's a way to bridge an economic gap because people are struggling and they need to help paying whatever bills they have. And then there's the other side of the argument that it's not a living wage. What is it doing exactly? And it might be trapping people in a rut. I mean, do you ever get enough money to pay your debt? Do you ever get ahead? What's your take? I mean, I think you're pro sustainable or basic income, but why won't you get stuck in a loop where you're not getting enough money to get out of the debt and the rut that you're in?
Well, you definitely, I know there's this whole theory, which could have merit to it, that whoever the globalists who are trying to impose one world government, they want everybody on a universal basic income so that we're all dependent on the state, you know, and then therefore we'll do whatever they say. But we're only dependent on the state if they cut off our ability to earn money privately, as happened right now. I mean, this is the ideal setup for the globalist New World Order. But for me personally, I've been on what you might call a supplemental income for 20 years, and it's absolutely not enslaving. It's freeing. I can write whatever I want. I don't have to. I get Social Security and a pension.
Mm-hmm.
So, and before that, I got spousal support. So, you know, I haven't had to work as a lawyer or go into the office for over 20 years, actually. And it's great to have some supplemental income, you know, some income coming in. Wealthy people have dividends coming in. So that's, I prefer calling it a national dividend. It's a dividend on the productivity of the whole country or the ability of the country to produce. And we do have a lot more ability to produce than we're actually using. So if you free people up to do what they really want to do, there have been studies showing that they're actually more productive than without this supplemental income. For one thing, it gives you a little money to, like, say you hate your job and you're working, putting all your effort into it, and you're so tired by the end of the day that you can't do anything else. It gives you a little cushion so that you could maybe take off, quit your job, and you could save up a few months while you go look for something else. Anyway, it certainly doesn't hurt to have supplemental income. It's not enough. We're actually short $1,200 a month on average between what people earn and what the cost of living is. So that's money that can only be acquired by borrowing. And that's why you have debt going up and up and up, because you've got to borrow some to supplement your cost of living. So if we gave people $1,200 a month, that would just balance things out. It would just eliminate the debt and make it all be real money, you know, be earned income and dividends.
What about the flip?
So you'd still be working for the rest of your income.
I get that. But what about the flip side of that? I mean, instead of, would it not be another way to look at it if you lower the taxes? The taxes are killing people. And there's a, you reach a certain amount that you make per year and you end up in a different tax bracket. It's really painful. So why not do it? What would be wrong with trying it that way, where we just stop getting taxed at the yin yang, which would give us more money in our pockets, which means your debt would go down? I'm looking at it from a healthcare perspective, right? Because this is a medical show. We always talk about giving money, like the Affordable Care Act is a perfect example, giving people money to help pay for their insurance. But there was never any talk about lowering the actual cost of healthcare. It's like you're chasing your tail. You have exorbitant costs made up, middlemen chalk through the entire system. Giving me more money to spend on something that's not worth that is not the answer, in my opinion. I would like to see real cost structure. And healthcare is my example. But then that also comes down to the paycheck. I mean, I have a small business. It's painful to see the payroll taxes come out. I know it is for my employees as well. Why doesn't that get taken care of? And then people would actually have money. And it would also change a little bit of the energy, where I want to do as well as I can, because the more money I make, the more money I keep, as opposed to the more money I make, the more they're going to take from me. What do you think about that mindset?
Yeah, well, that's a whole different subject. It'd probably be worth another show. But so my recommendation, which I've also written about, is that we have a financial transaction tax, like eliminate the income tax. It was a big constitutional issue whether it was even constitutional to do it. a financial transaction tax of 0.1%. I mean, right now we're paying sales tax of 10% mm-hmm. on shoes and school bags and things we really need. And in the stock market, all those trades, they're paying zero for their trades.
Wow.
As a tax. So if you put a tax of 0.1% on all financial transactions, this would be your purchases at the department store and your stock purchases. For ordinary people, they only buy stocks, you know, every few months, even if they're in the stock market, they're not like trading all day, every day. It's the financial, the high frequency program traders, which is largely done by computer, you know, where they're just doing these things second after second after second, doing these trades, which is what's actually messing up the market. You'd get rid of that. They probably couldn't operate. But anyway, there are all kinds of financial transactions that could be taxed at a very low rate. Now, the ideal way to do that is, I mean, virtually everything's digital already. So we virtually have a digital system. And so all your trades that are digital, like you do it with a credit card or whatever, it would just be automatic. It would just come right out of the thing. You don't have to ever write a check for anything. It's just like your sales taxes come off automatically, but it would reduce the sales tax way down.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just, there's $5 trillion worth of $5 trillion are traded every day in one form or another, U.S. dollars. That's one reason there's so much demand for dollars, even abroad, because they trade in dollars. So there's a huge amount of transactions in dollars. If you tax those, even at 0.1%, you're going to have way more money than you get now from income taxes.
Wow.
In other words, we're taxing the wrong portion. We're not mm-hmm. taxing the whole pie.
Mm-hmm.
And we're taxing the wrong portion that, as you say, is hurting ordinary people more mm-hmm. than anyone else. And the whole graduated income tax, like you say, it discourages you from earning more money. Whereas a basic income is not going to discourage you from earning more money. It's just extra dividend that goes into your bank account, and you know, you can use it to buy stocks if you don't need it or whatever you want to use it for.
Well, I want to revisit that because I have a question about that, about the how you get to use it. But let's take our last break. You're living the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. And you know, before the break, we were talking about this basic income. Well, if the government is giving you money to you as a stipend, a dividend, are they going to get to say how you get to use the money? If you're in debt, for example, will they say, hey, you own student loans, so we're taking that every month so that we can make sure you cover your federal student loan, or you have a mortgage? And I mean, is this going to be your money to do what you want to do, or is there going to be strings attached?
Well, you can see that both ways. And in good times, like right now, people don't want to pay down their student loan if they can't buy food. Mm-hmm. They definitely need the money for their necessities. But when you pay down debt, the money disappears. And that's why you could do, it's going to be, I think, $3 trillion to pay everybody $1,200 a month. But, for a year. But if a large portion of that money went to pay down debt, then that money is going to disappear. So we're not talking about inflating the money supply by $3 trillion. And much of it, the part that doesn't go to pay down debt is going to largely be people that don't need it to pay down debt. So they'll probably put it in the stock market, which is not going to inflate consumer prices either. And for the small amount that actually would go toward consumer goods and services from people that didn't have debt, that would just stimulate the economy. And, you know, we need some extra money out there to you need demand before the producers will come up with the supply.
True.
But I do see the issue. But if you've got, let's say you've got credit card debt, I saw a TV show. It was all about helping young people pay their debts. And these young people didn't realize that they thought that they didn't know why their debts were so high, but they thought that if they paid the minimum on their credit card, that they were okay. And they didn't realize what that meant was that they were racking up 20% interest compounded annually on their cards, which that's why their bills were going up and up and up. And so if you've got the money, you're definitely better off paying off your credit card than just paying the minimum and then spending it on something else. You see what I mean? Or saving it or whatever people do that they don't quite understand. And if you're, it seems like my son had student debt and he paid it every month. You know, you'd rather pay it than wind up in default. And then you're going to, they can raise rates in other ways and make it worse. I mean, you really do want to pay off your regular debts. So if you get money in to do that, that's, let's say, I think his was like $200 a month or something. If you get money in to do that, that's $200 that you can now spend that you couldn't spend before because you had to pay your credit card or your student debt. So you still, you know, you still get it to spend, but if it goes to pay down debt, then it cancels out the debt.
Well, you know, you,
or it cancels out the dollars.
The last book you wrote, you said it, you had solutions and how if you were in control of our economy and you could pronounce what would happen to fix it, what would you do?
Yeah, well, I do that, UBI, $1,200 a month or whatever. It could be adjusted, but whatever was needed to fill that gap between debt and the money available to repay it. And a financial transaction tax instead of an income tax or a sales tax, eliminate both of those. And nationalize the Federal Reserve, make it into, not only do we need like representation from the people, like the local community on those boards, but we also need access to their 0.25% loans with unlimited ability to roll them over, which you could do through public banks. So I would say a network of public banks headed by a central bank, which is not, it's not a central bank controlling things and calling shots. We're talking about a central bank that is the provider of liquidity. The, that's what the central bank supposedly was originally, was the reserves. It was where you draw the credit from and, you know, that backs everything.
Well,
you don't have to even call
would
it
that central bank be national or would it be a global syndicate?
Oh, well, I was thinking natural. I guess in a way you could eliminate the central bank if you would just acknowledge that all we're doing is creating credit on the books. But I was thinking of more of the central bank as being sort of a, as they say in China, a dumb pipe that the banks were complaining that they would become no more than dumb pipes for these, you know, WeChat and these other, where people were using their phones as a bank, basically. And the bank itself was just where they were drawing the money from. So that's what I was picturing the Federal Reserve as being, where you're just drawing the money from, and it's where you keep track of the accounts, sort of. But it could just be in your local banks. I guess you wouldn't even really need a Federal Reserve board. Maybe you need a board to determine, you know, tax rates, but that would be Congress. Yeah, I think you could actually eliminate the central bank. That's a good point.
Let's get rid of all the excess who don't perform a service, who graft off the system. If we could do that and have a template for that in healthcare, it'd be amazing. You know, in our world, it's the PBMs and the insurance companies and the all these things that are making money, providing a supposed service, jacking the price up. They got to go. And this is, you know, the public bank, I love that option. I love that, that thought that I'm going to deal with somebody who is working for me, not for themselves. And I'm curious, is there a difference between a public bank and a credit union? Is that some version of it?
A credit union is owned by the members, but they put a lot of restrictions on credit unions. So you couldn't actually use a credit union for for dealing with the city's funds. And then the problem is that it still has, it's still privately owned. It's privately owned by a group rather than, I mean, it's privately owned by the depositors themselves rather than by shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
But the benefits still go to that group. They're not, it's not designed to serve the local community by making like below market loans into the community.
Gotcha. I'd still, if you have to take a step, to me, it's a step in the right direction compared to some global bank who's designed to make money. That's all they want. And they're definitely not looking out for the community.
Right. And anything we can do to go more local is good. I mean, we're seeing that now where we've got these big conglomerates like the big butcher, you know, the places where they do meat.
Oh, yeah.
Processing plants. Mm-hmm. There are only a handful of them. And one of them shuts down, and that means all these farmers have to kill their cows because mm-hmm. they don't have any place to send them off to be processed. So we definitely need to bring all that back into our local communities, all those things that we've outsourced to these big oligopoly corporations.
Now, you mentioned North Dakota. Are there any, aside from, what was it, the... Oh my gosh! I forget the island you talked about. Is there anybody?
Oh,
any other
American Samoa.
Sorry. Any other states looking at this?
Oh, states are definitely looking at it. That's why I said we've got 25 bills on.
Good. Is Georgia one of them?
Country. No.
Oh.
Unfortunately.
Okay.
but if you want to start, we've got a whole network. We've got a public banking institute .org. We've got all kinds of data for you or stuff for you to use to get started or join us. Come and see our, we've got every month we have a webinar type or a Zoom call once a month mm-hmm. where we chat with people and tell them what's going on and try to explain, you know, answer their questions.
Well, actually,
and we've got a newsletter. And
yeah. Tell us what that is. Give us those addresses. Cause that would be something that people would love to know so they can make, you know, stop thinking about it and do something.
Yeah, that's what we did. publicbankinginstitute.org is that. And then my own website is ellenbrown.com, where all my articles are that, you know, I've done hundreds of articles on this subject.
Well, time just goes so quickly. I learned a great deal and I have a whole different take now on the sustainable income. I'm kind of the mindset that I want to keep my money. I don't really want to depend on anybody, specifically the government, because things do go down where they stop paying you or you have to jump through hoops, and there has to be some safeguard so that you're not going to be held hostage. And I'm sure that's something that you thought about with that, with the universal basic income too, right?
Yeah, well, to me, the safeguards are to allow people to continue to work. I mean, if they're going to block us from working, of course, then we're stuck. And allow us to keep our cash. Virtually everything can be digital,
mm-hmm.
but you still want to keep some cash around and some gold around just in case, because
mm-hmm.
who knows? I mean, even if it's all on the up and up, what if the internet goes down? How are you going to do your trades? So
it's a good point. So we have like a half a minute left. How do people reach you?
Probably my website's the best, ellenbrown.com. And my books are on Amazon. So that's, or I can give my email is
yep.
ellenhbrown@gmail.com.
Well,
my books are on Amazon.
Thank you so much. And we'll have that linked in the show notes. So when people listen to the podcast, they'll have that information as well. I want to thank you so much for your time. It was very educational, and I learned a lot. I'm sure my listeners did too. And I'm looking forward to reading your books, and you're welcome to come back on the show anytime.
Well, thank you, Elena. I've enjoyed talking to you.
It's a pleasure. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Mm-hmm. Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.